Howie Carr, in a focused little way, you're a great hero of mine because you've, over the years, told the story, the Boston story, that somehow hasn't made any of the papers and all this coverage of, you know, the new Boston, new restaurants, new this, new that. And that is the Bulger story. The simple fact that for the first time in 25 or 30 years, we live in an almost Bulger-free zone. I mean, who would believe, who coming from Kansas or Arizona or California even would believe that for so many years, two brothers ran everything. One ran the State House and the other ran the cocaine cartel, and they were inseparable. You could not get a dime's width between them. They were intimate. They were loyal to each other. And now, to all intents and purposes, they're gone. Do you want to explain for the beginners how this happened?
Well, there were these two brothers, Billy Bulger and his older brother, Whitey. Whitey was a criminal from just about the moment he was born in 1929, and he slowly worked his way up through the rungs of organized crime, spent a little time in Alcatraz in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and as he was finishing up his sentence for bank robbery, his brother Billy, his younger brother Billy, who was a graduate of Boston College High School, undergraduate and the law school, was elected to the state legislature, and first to the House and then to the Senate. And oddly enough, as Whitey began moving up through the rackets in the Boston underworld, his brother Billy began simultaneously moving up through the overworld of politics at the State House.
Simultaneously and not quite coincidentally. I mean, I just wonder, have you ever written it this way? I've come to think of Whitey Bulger as our Osama bin Laden in this sense. One, they'd never been seen together. For another, Osama bin Laden and Whitey Bulger were both empowered by the security establishment. Osama to get the Russians out of Afghanistan, Whitey nominally to get the Italians in the mob. And in both cases, the feds produced these killer monsters, and then lo and behold, they disappeared. They're gone. Can't find them. But they both, to me, embody genuine and rather comparable forms of terrorism.
I'd never thought of it that way, Chris, but that's not a bad way of looking at it. And the fact, too, is that they're right at the top of the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Osama's number one, and I guess you'd call Whitey number two. But, yes, in a sense, too, that the security apparatus, whether it was the FBI in the case of Whitey, the domestic terrorist, or Osama, the CIA and the military, they set him up. They set these guys up as foils to people they considered to be great enemies. And then the great irony is that when the enemies were vanquished, they had an even more evil foe on their hands, Osama and Whitey. Whitey is a guy who did things that at least the local branch of the mafia, I don't think, ever considered doing, which was basically killing girlfriends, using machine guns on city streets, just basically random slayings of anyone who got in their way. The death threats against businessmen, against reporters. Billy Bulger, of course, in one of the more famous attempts to take complete control of Greater Boston, went to the mayor of Boston and suggested that an FBI agent now in prison, who was basically a member of Whitey's gang, be installed as police commissioner of the city of Boston. In other words, Billy Bulger was trying to put a member of organized crime in as the top law enforcement officer in the city of Boston.
We already had a police commissioner, Mickey Roach, whose brother, by good report, had been shot, disabled for life by none other than Whitey himself.
Well, either Whitey or a fellow named O'Sullivan, but the fact is, yeah, Whitey was there when it happened in the best telling of the story. Yes, there was a former president of the city council whose brother was slain in one of these South Boston gang wars. You have the current floor leader of the Massachusetts House, his name and telephone number turned up in the address book of a mafia figure known as the Animal. Of course, he was just the divorce lawyer, or so he claims.
See, this is so hard to explain to people, and even around here, a lot of people have been just unwilling to believe that we live in a town that was run, to all intents and purposes, by the mob. I mean, if this happened, I've always said, if this happened in Medellin in Colombia, you know, people would say, well, what do you expect? I mean, that's a cocaine city. Or Marseille, say, in the 40s, people would have said, well, you know, you got to expect. But this is Boston.
Well, Chris, I think, too, that you have to remember that this is not just state politics, although you and I both know that Billy had a great deal of influence over a number of statewide office holders, including Mike Dukakis, who, let's not forget, was almost elected president of the United States. However, it goes beyond that. The Bulger family has close, or at least Billy has close ties to the Bush family, and it goes back to 1988. Now, according to stories that are told by members of the Bush family, in 1988, it was Billy Bulger who suggested that George H.W. Bush, down 17 points in the polls, bring his roadshow, his political campaign, to Boston and take a ride around the harbor to point out the ineptitude of Mike Dukakis. And I've always heard that George H.W. Bush thought that that was the beginning of the turnaround in the 88 campaign when he sailed the Boston Harbor. And the fact is, Chris, as you well know, that in the year 2000, when they were scouting around, both parties together, hand in glove, for the site of the first presidential debate, guess where they picked? The University of Massachusetts at Boston, of which Billy Bulger was the president. And, of course, Ted Kennedy had sort of made his peace with Billy Bulger. He's going to have all of his papers down there at the library at Ted Kennedy Building. And George H.W. Bush and his son, they felt they owed Billy a favor, and he called in the chit.
But this is so perfectly typical, and also of the connection between Billy and Whitey. I mean, first of all, you know, you wouldn't want him as a friend because the first thing he'd do would sell you out. In the Whitey case, he let that Valhalla ship go with arms for the IRA. As soon as it was, you know, out to sea, dropped a dime with the CIA or wherever it was, and the thing was captured. So both of them always play both sides, it seems to me.
You have to finish the story.
Go ahead.
And then he takes a contract to kill one of the crew members, and does kill one of the crew members for ratting out the ship, even though in all likelihood he was the one who ratted out the ship. It's like something out of an early George V. Higgins novel. The guy is taking contracts to kill people when he actually was the one who should be assassinated by his fellow members of the mob.
What do you mark as the kind of high water peak of the Bill Bulger's power, between running the state senate and having this kind of mob violence as a threat behind him? I mean, how high did it go?
I would have to say the late 80s would have been the pinnacle of Bulger's power. The governor of the state was Mike Dukakis, and he was basically, at the end, a pawn of Billy Bulger. Mike Dukakis, who had been elected as a reformer, just had adopted a go-along-to-get-along attitude. One time, a state trooper in a famous incident at Logan Airport stopped Whitey Bulger from taking apparently $50,000 to $100,000 cash out of the country. The next day, Mike Dukakis's head of Logan Airport showed up at the state police barracks at the airport and demanded to see a copy of the report involving Whitey's attempt to get this money out. The state trooper was later transferred to the boondocks and later ended up committing suicide.
Are you sure that wasn't under Governor Weld?
I'm positive. That was under Mike Dukakis.
Okay.
1987.
Okay. Either way, you know, it seems to me Bulger would have had a new dimension of unheard-of power if John Silber had been elected in 1990, because he had put Silber into the race, effectively, with convention votes, and he would have owned him lock, stock, and barrel. How do you suppose Silber would have dealt with that?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Chris, because I think that I'm not the only person who voted for Weld over Silber, because I was concerned about the Bulger connection.
You are not the only one, brother. I'm with you.
but the fact is that within a few years, he ended up owning the brain of the Republican governor who would run against him in 1990, and had made these points about how Bulger would control everything. You might say that he had more power at the state house level under Weld than he even had under Dukakis.
Absolutely. I never figured this out, why Weld took a dive. There was that famous moment in the summer of that campaign. I'm sure you remember it. 52 Bulger cocaine associates all arrested. Not Whitey, but the whole gang. and he was an unindicted co-conspirator. Bill Weld denounced it, said this is what we're looking at in the Democratic Party. But within a few months, he was in bed with Bulger, and the two of them ran everything under that state house together.
It was like Bill Weld. This is maybe technical for the listeners, but he had the veto power. He could sustain any veto that he wanted to because he had 16 senators in the in Bulger's branch, the state senate. He started appointing his own state senators that were elected out of Democratic districts to bureaucratic positions because he somehow thought that Bulger was his friend, that he didn't need to worry about sustaining a veto in the Senate. It was a terrible tactical mistake for Bill Weld and for the Republican Party, and I would argue for the people in general. But for some reason, he just grew to really like Bill Bulger, and he of course had made jokes. As we know, he made jokes about Whitey at the St. Patrick's Day breakfast when Bulger had his retirement dinner earlier this year at the Boston Public Library. Who was the host? Who flew up from New York? None other than William Floyd Weld.
What is that about? I just never got it. Although it may also have gone back earlier in the fact that Bill Weld had been a U.S. attorney, federal prosecutor, who was in on this kind of monstrous conceit that Whitey was helping the feds and the U.S. attorney and the organized crime strike force get the Italians. I mean, was that the critical mistake that Bill Weld had made and had to kind of live with?
He didn't seem to take it seriously. I get the feeling that a lot of these Yankee types, for lack of a better phrase, didn't take Billy that seriously. I mean, going back to the days of Frank Sargent, the former Republican governor in the late 60s, early 70s, who offered him a judgeship, even senators like Oliver Ames, you still talk to them, and old Yankee types, they found him to be a charming rascal, a rogue. Bill Saltonstall, the state senator from up on the North Shore, son of Leverett Saltonstall, the former U.S. senator, another guy who really loved Billy Bulger. And I think for some reason he was able to charm Weld like he was all those earlier Yankee Republicans. There was a weird moment in the hearings in 1998 when Bill Weld was called as a witness as the former U.S. attorney. They were trying to decide whether they should continue the racketeering prosecution against Steve Flimmy, Whitey's partner, and Whitey because they were FBI agents. And Weld recounted this story about how the number two guy in the FBI office said to him of a man named Brian Halloran, who was shortly thereafter mowed down in South Boston by Whitey himself. He said, you know, I wouldn't want to be standing too close to Brian Halloran about now. This is what the FBI agent said to Weld. And as he recounted it, he began chuckling on the witness stand. And it was a very perplexing moment because everybody in the courtroom was thinking to themselves, what's so funny, Governor?
Why is this man laughing? You're right. He did take in all of those sort of Boston Symphony Board and Massachusetts General Hospital board members. They loved little Billy Bulger. He's such an amusing fellow there from South Boston, all that stuff. But it seems to me part of the problem was that they were allowed to do that. I mean, he was allowed to make himself this little leprechaun. He could sing a song on an occasion, didn't watch television, pretended to have read, you know, to be able to read Latin and Greek. That was partly because the media, that's us, everybody but you in many ways, although I had a little hand in it sometimes.
You're being modest, Chris.
Well, no, but we gotta talk about the media role in this. Allowed Billy to get away with this picture of, you know, little Mr. Shamrock. But I'd like you to cover what you think are both the heroes and the villains of this piece. And I just throw out for a start on the villains list. We'll come to the heroes. But, you know, the FBI, totally incompetent here, including, you know, vaunted reputations like Jeremiah O'Sullivan and all the federal prosecutors, including Bill Weld. John Silber got taken in, lock, stock, and barrel. The church got taken in. Bill Weld, for sure. The Globe, it seems to me, has had a mixed record because Kevin Cullen did some very good reporting work. On the other hand, Mike Barnicle fronted freely for, not just for Bulger, but for your friend Zip Connolly, the FBI agent who was orchestrating the defense of Bulger.
Now in prison.
Now, and Barnicle should be there with him. I mean, really, really. who were the villains that kind of turned their back, and why did they do it? Was it fear? Were they in on it, or what?
I think it was Bugsy Siegel who said, we only kill each other, and I think there was an element of that. They just figured, well, Whitey's only killing dirtballs. You know, these people are no good. Actually, one time when there was someone killed outside of Whitey's bar, Triple O's, just across what used to be the bridge here, Conley went to the district attorney and said, what are you worried about this case for? This guy is just a piece of bleep. So there was an element of that, and I think the FBI, most of the largest share of the blame falls on them. Chris, it wasn't just a couple of agents who were bad. We're talking here about two generations of FBI agents. First, you had the Dennis Condons and the Bob Sheehans and most importantly the H. Paul Ricos, who recently died while in a prison cell in Oklahoma awaiting charges, first degree murder charges, a trial. And then they're succeeded by the second generation, the Zip Connollys, the John Morris, the guy who took the $5,000 in cash one night, the guy who tipped off Whitey, they're tipped off through Zip that this guy Brian Halloran had become a witness. I mean, these guys, they not only fronted for Whitey, but they also fronted for Billy. It was John Morris and Zip Connolly who flew down to Texas, and it's again a long, complicated story, and interviewed the witnesses who brought down the majority leader of the Massachusetts Senate, who, if he hadn't been convicted of taking bribes, would have become the state Senate president. There wouldn't have been a Billy Bulger. Forget Whitey Bulger. There wouldn't have been a Billy Bulger without Zip Connolly and John Morris, FBI agents.
I want you to touch on the sort of media scorecard, because again, the media made this all possible. I'd love your review of the Globe. It seems to me there's a mixed bag over there. There's been some good reporting. At the same time, when we on the 10 o'clock news of late reported that Bill Bulger had taken a $250,000 piece of a so-called fee, a shakedown fee, from the only partner he ever had, Tom Finnerty. Right after that, on 60 Minutes, Mike Barnicle pops up and says, well, one thing you got to say about Billy, you know, he's never put the arm on anybody for a dime. And I said, Mike, how about $250K? But in any event, Barnicle was always covering. Brian McGrory in the Globe wrote in his column that brotherly love explained why Billy was taking the fifth when asked to testify about his connections with his brother. So the Globe has been very credulous. But the other thing is, the New Yorker magazine published an incredibly dismal suck-up piece by Richard Brookhiser about Bill Bulger, and 60 Minutes, fearless 60 Minutes, did a terrific leprechaun number on Bill. I called Mike Wallace at the time because I knew they were working on it. I said, Mike, you're from here. You know this is important. He said, I know, but it's Morley Safer's story. And it was obscene.
Well, as you probably recall, Chris, we sat in the Channel 2 newsroom one afternoon, and it took us about 20 minutes to knock out a real 60-minute story, and we were using all video that had existed. And I believe we told 60 Minutes that all this video existed that could paint a damning portrait of the corrupt midget, as Judge Dare called him, and we never heard back from them. I think, though, locally, what you have to remember, and I think the pivotal moment, and no one really wants to admit that this played such a role on many people. Paul Corsetti, he's now deceased. He was a reporter for the Herald American. He was working on a story about a gangland slaying over there involving a bookmaker turned drug dealer named Louis Litoff. And he started asking questions about what happened. He was he received an anonymous phone call and was invited down to a bar in Quincy Market for more information. He was a Vietnam vet, a tough guy, second generation street reporter for the Hearst organization. He shows up down there, and he's sitting at the bar, and all of a sudden, to make a long story short, he's confronted by Whitey Bulger. And Whitey says to him, I'm the guy who called you. I'm the guy you're looking for. I want to tell you a few things. Pulls a piece of paper out of his pocket, reads off the home address of Paul Corsetti, reads off his license plate number, make and model of his car, his wife's license plate, make and model, and where his wife drops off his young daughter at daycare every day, and says, that's all you need to know about me, and then walks out of the bar. Next day, I still remember it like it was yesterday, Paul Corsetti shows up in the city room here at the Herald wearing a .38 caliber on his hip, because he's that frightened. They go to the police department. The police department say, we've got Whitey for 50 murders, but we can't do anything. So being an Italian, Corsetti says, well, I'll play the ethnic card. I'll go see Larry Bayoni, the toughest mafia enforcer, the number two guy in the local LCN. And Larry says, okay, what can I do for you, Paul? He says, I need a favor. He says, whatever you say. And he says, well, it's about Whitey Bulger. And Larry immediately goes, hey, throws up his arms and says, hey, I can help you with anybody else, but not him. He's bleeping crazy. And then they finally got word back to him that they were just interested in Louis Litif, that they weren't interested in the brother. Apparently, Whitey was concerned that Paul was going after Billy Bulger. And they got the whole thing straightened out. But you know what, Chris, for 5 years... there was next to nothing that appeared in either paper about Whitey and Billy. And those were pivotal years. Those were the years when when Billy went after Johnny Powers, the clerk of the Supreme Judicial Court in Suffolk County, for firing Whitey from his job.
That's the same Johnny Powers, former Senate president, who said to me one time, Chris, it's exactly as if Al Capone's brother was the president of the Illinois State Senate and everybody agreed just not to talk about it.
Yeah. They operated with impunity. I mean, the story that I always remember, I worked at Channel 56, which is right next to the Globe, so I would have to go between here and the South End in Dorchester, and I would have to go, the most direct way is right by the liquor store Whitey owned. And for some reason, when I'd finish up work at Channel 56, I would never get a cold one for the ride home at the South Boston Liquor Mart. And one night they mentioned that to Jack Hines, the son of the mayor, and he was the anchor man at Channel 56. And I guess it was probably Kevin Weeks, one of the gravedigger for the mob, who was behind the counter. And he said, hey, Jack, how come Howie never comes in here? And Jack kind of, you know, gave it a shrug. And whoever it was said, will you tell Howie that if he comes in here, we'll be ready for him? We got a new dumpster right out back with his name on it. It'll be another Robin Benedict.
Well, you know, this gets serious, Howie, because every reporter knew the Paul Corsetti story. I mean, in some versions, Whitey said to him, my name is Whitey Bulger. I kill people for a living. But everybody was scared. Everybody was terrified, terrorized, and it worked for him. How did it affect you? Did it scare you?
Oh, yeah, it scared me, definitely. I used to go home a different way every night. I was concerned. And then I wrote the first story after Corsetti for Boston Magazine, and I thought that the Globe was working on a story, too. So I didn't realize I'd be hanging out there all by myself in Boston Magazine. And then we get the word from the quote-unquote FBI, which I now know was Connolly, saying, tell Howie to watch his step in South Boston. And Kevin Cullen from the Globe got the same thing. You know, he gets a call from Tom Daley, who's, again, one of the fringe Connolly Morris type agents at the office, and he's told, well, if you write a story saying that Whitey is an informer for the FBI, you know, he knows where you live in South Boston, and he could kill you. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty frightening. I mean, even if you suspect that they're just bragging about their right. prowess, you know, you can't. These are guys who, in 1 week. 1 year, and it was 1973, they machine-gunned two people. And they were on major, not on side streets. One of them, they machine-gunned a guy on Morrissey Boulevard, and 4 days earlier, they'd machine-gunned somebody else on Commercial Street in the North End. I mean, they walked into a coffee shop in downtown Medford Square and blew somebody away in front of a dozen witnesses.
You're right, and I knew Don Colleen, who was supposed to be the toughest guy. I mean, he was the toughest guy I ever met. Huge, ham-handed, had the booking exclusive in Upham's Corner and whatnot. Everybody I knew thought he was the toughest guy in the world. Killed, presumably by Whitey Bulger, in his own front yard in Framingham because Whitey wanted the corner. And even I remember a state cop giving me directions, actually, one 4th of July. My daughter was in the car, and he said, Senator Bulger will be waiting for you at the end of the Longfellow Bridge. That was supposed to be a joke, I guess. But, you know, they were all watching.
Yeah, and it helped Billy Bulger. You know, you have the famous quote from Kevin White about how if my brother threatened to kill you, you'd be nothing but nice to me. And right. You know, people knew that. And
that's another part of the joke that that people went along with. I won't say who it was, but a world famous stage director said to me one time, he was fascinated by the Bulger story. I said, why? You live in Los Angeles, you work all around the world. And he said, no, it's so interesting. I read the papers, and what's so obvious to me is that the so-called good brother is, in truth, the really, really bad brother. There's no separation between the two, and it's Billy who's reaping the fruit.
Yeah, I remember one time being out on a boat with Jerry Indelicato. It turned out he was a crooked Dukakis guy who ended up going to jail shortly thereafter. And he was on the boat with me and Frank Phillips, now of the Globe and formerly of the Herald. And Indelicato looked at me and said, do you know how much Senate President Bulger would give me to throw you off this boat? And he was half serious and half kidding, I should say, but maybe there was just a grain of truth to what he was saying. And then later on I find out that he is the nephew of Teddy Deegan, the fringe mobster that the FBI framed, sent four innocent men to death row back in 1968 for just to take mafia people off the street. And it all comes back to J. Edgar Hoover getting the directive, I think, from RFK in 1961, saying you got to go after the mafia. And once they said that any ends justified the means to get rid of the mafia, that's what unleashed this hurricane in the city of Boston.
Let's talk about the other heroes in this story. I mean, you're number one in my book because you've written about it fearlessly. You've made it funny, but you've made it real over many, many years. I give Judge Mark Wolf very high points for blowing the whistle on the FBI. I mean, he was in the prosecutor's office when it was being compromised, but then went back and insisted on hearings about it. George Dare, the original housing court victim of Bulger, spoke up. Michael McDonough wrote a very illuminating book called All Souls about the terror in South Boston. And then Dick Lehr and Jerry O'Neill at the Globe did a good book called Black Mass on it. Who else do you put on the honor roll? Or just people who stood up?
Well, Chris, you should be on the honor roll. You really should.
No,
Let's not forget what happened at Channel 2's 10 o'clock news, because after you and David Boeri, who definitely should be on the list, you guys went after Bulger big time, and you, as a public broadcasting entity, you were at risk, perhaps more than some of the rest of us. And as we know, the Channel 2 had a yearly auction. They needed a liquor license. Somehow you guys had a problem getting the liquor license, didn't you?
Well, I was enjoined against mentioning Mr. Bulger on the air, and I said, this is absurd. And then I won't have any part of the injunction. Suddenly the 10 o'clock news was history. It was over. But
that's a heavy price to pay, lose your job. I give you another example of a guy who almost paid a heavy price, lost his job, was State Police Colonel Jack O'Donovan. This is a guy they went after hammer and tong to get him off, because he was an honest cop. He put the bug in the Lancaster Street garage in 1980, and what was his reward? A surreptitiously filed outside section to the budget that would have forced him and three other senior state police officers to retire. And give Governor King credit, he vetoed that. And you know, the odd thing is, for all the grief that Ed King took as being a troglodyte Democrat, Ronald Reagan's favorite Democratic governor, et cetera, Ed King stood up more to Billy Bulger and the mob than Mike Dukakis did, I believe.
And so in the end did Tom Riley, the AG. I mean, proving that an Irishman could stand up.
Tom Riley had a lot to answer for after he took a $100 contribution from Zip Connolly in his first race for Attorney General. In my estimation, however, he did realize the enormity of his error. Shall we say he returned the money and turned on Bulger with a vengeance?
Is the nightmare over? You still on your wonderful webpage, HowieCard.com, which I got to mention. You have a wonderful picture of the putative nominee of the Democratic Party, John Kerry, in one of those laugh-it-up moments with Bill Bulger in South Boston. Does he have any hold on anybody anymore?
Chris, I don't think he does. I like that photograph, and I would advise anyone who enjoys old-time photos and old-time FBI memos to go to HowieCard.com and click on the Whitey Watch, and you'll see all that stuff. However, I had an incident recently. His brother-in-law, one of the last of his generation of Bulgers on the state payroll, retired from his job as head of the environmental police. Again, he's not connected, but still, it's rather odd that
Green Bulger
to have a Bulger running any kind of police force, even a green police force. However, he retired, and I got a call a couple of days after I wrote a column about it, saying another Bulger had gone on to a major pension, and said, "Howie, they've just rehired him as a consultant." And I thought to myself, isn't that 1987? And I must admit, I believed it was true. And I immediately started making calls. And guess what? It's not true. They did not give this Bulger in-law, Bill McKeon, a chance to make even more dough. He's retired permanently.
Thanks in major part to you, Howie Carr. I think it's a huge credit to you that you've
Come on, Chris, hung in straight on the strike.
Well, I was a very minor player there. It did cost me, but you were out there calling him the corrupt midget, in the great words of George Dare, all those years, the CM, and Whitey, you called the Caucasian. That took a lot of wit and a lot of guts over many years. Howie Carr, thank you.
Chris, as I always used to tell you, you know, when you'd say, "I'm very worried," and I'd say, "Chris, if he's in triple O's, he's going to kill me first. He'll kill me. You'll hear about it on the radio while he's driving over to your place."
Chris Lydon, wounded by shrapnel in Howie Carr assassination. Howie, thank you.
Thank you, Chris.